Hello and welcome to this episode of the Northwestern University Law Review Online's podcast series. My name is Matt Monahan, senior online editor for the Law Review. Northwestern Law Review Online publishes articles and essays on a broad range of topics in the law. The podcast series focuses on our recently published content and also explores new and relevant legal topics. Today's episode features two Northwestern faculty members, both scholars of constitutional law and the court, discussing the legal legacy of the late Justice Antonin Scalia. Stephen Calabresi is the Clayton J. and Henry R. Barber Professor of Law, as well as a former law clerk for Justice Scalia. Andrew Koppelman is the Justice John Paul Stevens Professor of Law, and most recently the author of The Tough Luck Constitution and the Assault on Healthcare Reform. Justice Scalia served on the Supreme Court from 1986 through 2016. In a touching tribute to her former colleague, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said of Justice Scalia, "He was a jurist of captivating brilliance and wit, with a rare talent to make even the most sober judge laugh." Known for his colorful writing and incisive legal analysis, Justice Scalia left his mark on everything from executive power to substantive due process to the role of international law in constitutional interpretation. His originalist philosophy left an indelible mark on what we understand the Constitution is and should be. I recently sat down with Professors Calabresi and Koppelman to discuss the extent of Justice Scalia's impact on the court and its jurisprudence, and what they believe his lasting legal legacy will be. Professor Calabresi, I'd like to start with you. In your USA Today tribute to Justice Scalia, you mentioned that he is the most important American Supreme Court justice in history. Why do you say that?
I think it's important to remember that when Justice Scalia arrived on the U.S. Supreme Court in 1986, none of the other eight justices really believed in the rule of law in the way that Justice Scalia believed in it. The other justices were children of legal realism, which is a movement that gained force in the 1920s and 1930s to the effect that all law is just politics, and what judges should do is legislate their policy preferences from the bench. There were on the Supreme Court in 1986 conservative legal realists like William Rehnquist and Byron White. There was a moderate legal realist, Sandra Day O'Connor and Lewis Powell. And there were liberal legal realists like William Brennan and Thurgood Marshall. But Justice Scalia believed in law, and he managed over the course of his 29 years on the court to leave behind a court that is much more committed to the rule of law than was the one that he joined. Other justices who have been famous in American history have never faced a challenge as great as the one that Justice Scalia faced in 1986 of having to persuade eight colleagues to follow the rule of law rather than simply legislating policy preferences from the bench. Justice Scalia can be compared favorably with other great Supreme Court justices. One person who comes to mind, of course, is John Marshall, the legendary Chief Justice, who, because he was essentially the longest-serving Chief Justice in American history, had a huge impact on American law. Chief Justice Marshall was a great figure, but he was prone to legal realism himself. He misread statutes on occasion to produce constitutional decisions, and he was in many ways a very political judge. Justice Scalia was not a political judge. He emphasized the importance of the original public meaning of the text of the Constitution and persuaded many people that was of central importance. And he also emphasized the importance of legal rules over legal standards. A rule, for example, is the requirement that the president be 35 years old. A standard, in contrast, would be a requirement that the president be a very mature individual. Justice Scalia's view was that as much as possible, the court should write its opinions in rule form and should eschew balancing tests, because that would minimize judicial discretion. So I think Scalia deserves to be called the greatest justice in American history because he changed the attitude of the whole Supreme Court toward following the rule of law. He defended the idea of the importance of the original public meaning of the text and persuaded many to follow him on that. And his opposition to balancing tests and his support for standards and for text over legislative history were monumentally influential.
Professor Koppelman, you disagree with Professor Calabresi on Justice Scalia's importance. Where do you see the justice in the course of American history?
Well, justice certainly was quite important. The dominant theme that Scalia himself emphasized about his judicial philosophy was judicial restraint, constraining judicial protection, not legislating policy preferences, and his big innovation within originalism, to focus on original public meaning rather than original intent, really has permanently changed the originalist school of jurisprudence. And I think that that's going to last because I think that it's more attractive to look at and just more coherent to look at original public meaning than original intention. But in the actual decisions that he made, he had a persistent tendency to read the sources in a way that aligned with his personal policy preferences, with a few notable exceptions. He's not enthusiastic about flag burning. He's not enthusiastic about criminal defendants. In those particular areas, he had procedural convictions that meant that he could live with results contrary to his views in those cases. But there were a number of cases, actually quite a lot of cases, where on the basis of really unpersuasive reasoning, he arrived at results that he liked. And I don't think that he was aware that he was doing this. But the two examples that I think are most prominent, one of them is Bush versus Gore, the case where the court, by a 5-4 margin, installed as President of the United States George W. Bush. And the vote counting in Florida wasn't finished. We're never going to know how it would have turned out if it had finished. But if one looks at the constitutional structure for selecting a president, it's quite clear that the Supreme Court has no role in assigned by the Constitution or by the statute. And the construction of the statute that allowed the court to intervene in the way that it did was frankly preposterous. And the idea that this result is reached by someone who is not interested in legislating his policy preferences, I think he just wasn't particularly self-aware. And then there's the remarkable dissent in the Obamacare case where he tried to blow up the entire statute on the basis of a previously unheard of constitutional objection. There's everything turned on the distinction between regulating action and inaction, and he held that it exceeded the commerce power to require people to purchase health insurance. But he had, just a couple of years earlier signed on to the rule, which had been around since 1819, that Congress has a broad power to choose any convenient means for carrying out its enumerated powers. There was no question that a mandate was convenient for carrying out the enumerated powers. And I think that you read his dissent in the healthcare case with, I just don't think that it's possible to read that opinion and figure out what he does with the rule of McCulloch versus Maryland. It's an obstacle to the result that he wants to reach, and he writes his opinion as if it were not there. I could give other examples, but in these cases, I think on the one hand, his official position was all about judicial restraint, but I think that that gets silently violated in decision after decision. So I think that he was sadly lacking in self-awareness of what he was doing.
May I respond to that? I would say that Justice Scalia was less an advocate of judicial restraint than he was an advocate of originalism and of the effectuating the original public meaning of the Constitution. And if the text of the Constitution called for striking something down, he struck it down. If the text didn't invalidate a law, he would uphold it. I think his guiding principle was that his policy views ought to play no role in the decisions he made as a judge. And I believe his policy views did not play a role in the positions he took as a judge. First of all, there are the areas that Professor Koppelman mentioned where Justice Scalia reached outcomes contrary to those that he would have favored as a legislator. In two cases, he joined 5-4 majorities striking down statutes that forbade flag burning. He certainly was no proponent of flag burning, but he was happy to be the fifth vote to strike that down on the First Amendment. But I would add that on the First Amendment more generally, he was a very expansive reader of the First Amendment, and he endorsed a viewpoint. He endorsed something called viewpoint neutrality, which is essentially the idea that the courts ought not to scrutinize the content of what people are saying in deciding whether or not to uphold it. So his broad First Amendment readings extended way beyond flag burning and included other categories of speech as well, including hate speech and pornography and commercial speech. On rights of criminal defendants, he was again very vigorous in defending criminal defendants' rights. That was true with the Confrontation Clause, which he read very aggressively and changed the court's understanding of the Confrontation Clause. It was also true with respect to the Fourth Amendment ban on unreasonable searches and seizures. In the last 2 years on the court, he struck down an effort by the police to attach a GPS tracking device to someone's car without getting a warrant. And he also struck down the use of drug-sniffing dogs at someone's front doorstep without a warrant. These are strong pro-Fourth Amendment opinions. Professor Koppelman says Scalia was political, but he accorded President Obama extensive Chevron deference at a time when Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy and Justice Alito were unwilling to do that. I do have to respond quickly to what Professor Koppelman said about Bush v. Gore and the healthcare case. In Bush v. Gore, the tally on election night after the votes had been counted showed former President George W. Bush with about a 600-vote lead over former Vice President Al Gore. The Secretary of State of Florida, whose business it is to conduct Florida elections, certified George W. Bush as the winner of the Florida election. Vice President Gore then sued in state court to overturn the Secretary of State's decision, and he was able to persuade the state court to allow three different counties to recount paper ballots using different standards for recounting paper ballots. And these paper ballots were punch card paper ballots, and all the ballots recounted were ones where a Chad was left hanging where somebody had tried to punch out a spot on the card. In some counties, a vote required that a Chad be hanging only by one corner. In other counties, a Chad could be counted as a vote if it was hanging by three corners. In some counties, dimpled Chads, where the Chad had not been separated from the paper at all, were being counted as a vote. What the Supreme Court said in Bush v. Gore was, this violates equal protection of the laws. It violates the equality principle that underlay the great Warren Court one person, one vote cases. And I think that's plainly right. I think that you cannot count paper ballots differently in one county from another county. The problem was that Florida should never have been using paper ballots in the first place. And that problem was not one of Justice Scalia's making. So I think that the criticism over Bush v. Gore is misplaced. On the healthcare case, Professor Koppelman notes that Justice Scalia's dissenting opinion agreed with Chief Justice Marshall's opinion in 1819 that the word necessary in the necessary and proper clause means convenient. However, the Marshall decision from 1819, while it defines the meaning of the word necessary, it does not define the meaning of the word proper. And Justice Scalia argued that it might be convenient to require people to enter the market and buy health insurance, but it wasn't proper for them to do so because in 225 years of American history, Congress had never, ever before required that someone buy something and enter the market. It had always regulated the market after people had bought something. Scalia's view was identical to the view of Roberts on the Necessary and Proper Clause. There were five votes for that view. The disagreement between Scalia and Roberts was that Roberts politically read the statute as being a tax, and he then upheld Obamacare as being a tax. The problem with what Roberts did is that the statute wasn't written as a tax. Everyone in Congress denied it was a tax, and President Obama claimed it was not a tax. So Roberts managed to uphold the statute as a tax while completely disregarding the text and legislative history of the statute. On the necessary and proper clause, Roberts agreed with Scalia, and there were 5 votes for that proposition.
So, Matt, I had just a couple of issues. One is on the flag burning. I mean, it's true that Scalia has been a strong proponent of viewpoint neutrality as a principle for interpreting the First Amendment, and we have had that principle in place for a long time, in fact, since the mid-20th century. Its originalist credentials are highly dubious. There is no evidence that any of the framers of the First Amendment or even anyone in the founding generation thought that when they adopted the First Amendment, that a general rule of viewpoint neutrality was the public meaning of the First Amendment. So this is an area where Scalia, I think, just has disregarded his originalism and done what pretty much every judge has done with the text of the First Amendment, which is pretty vague, which is to adopt a political philosophy according to which defense of free speech makes sense and read the First Amendment in light of that. So it's constrained by precedent, but it's certainly not originalist. On Bush versus Gore, whatever one thinks of the vote counting procedure, the genuinely alarming thing about the decision and the most vulnerable bit of it was the remedy, where if the court was unhappy with the way that the votes were being counted. And I'll note that different procedures for dealing with things such as hanging chads have gone on in the United States all along, and for all I can tell, continues to go on to this day. There is no general rule in states about how to count doubtful ballots, and a rule hasn't been enforced since Bush versus Gore. But then you would have thought that the remedy would be for the court to remand and say, well, do this and impose Florida. You've got to impose a uniform standard and actually count the votes according to that uniform standard and see how it comes out. But the court in Bush versus Gore evidently didn't want to take the chance of the vote count coming out the wrong way. And so they quite extraordinarily, on the basis of our genuinely heroic reading of the statute, said, you know, Congress's intention was for the votes to stop now, even though, you know, we're not really sure how the votes would come out if our instructions were followed and they were counted according to a uniform standard, but we're not going to take any chances the vote count stops now. And just accidentally, coincidentally, happens to be the case that the winner is the guy whose political inclinations coincide with that of the 5 justices in the majority. This doesn't seem to me to be originalism or judicial restraint. On the healthcare law, I don't think that Scalia's view was identical with Roberts. Roberts resuscitated a line from 1819 McCulloch versus Maryland that Congress couldn't exercise any great substantive and independent power. For reasons not explained, Scalia didn't join that bit of the reasoning, which actually was based on a rule, albeit in, I think, fundamentally unintelligible rule, but Roberts did come up with something that looked like a rule. Instead, he just said, you can't ever require anyone to buy something, which also doesn't seem to have any originalist credentials. In fact, it was never heard of until opponents of Obamacare invented it and attributed it to the Constitution and challenged it on that basis. This, again, is neither judicial restraint nor is it originalism.
Okay, quick response. There was no unanimity on the First Amendment and viewpoint neutrality. The flag burning cases were 5-4 opinions. So 4 justices clearly took the less First Amendment protective position. Other justices who served on the court with Scalia, including Justice Sam Alito and former Chief Justice William Rehnquist, wrote opinions that were less protective of the First Amendment than Scalia did. As to Bush v. Gore and staying the further counting of the paper ballots, the stay only was issued when a federal statutory deadline for counting the electoral votes had become pressing and imminent, and it was necessary to issue the stay in order to make sure that Florida's electoral votes would be counted for that election. And as I say, I think that the court's intervention in Bush v. Gore follows on a quarter century of law professors urging the Supreme Court to police the democratic process, as John Hart Ely called it, in Democracy and Distrust, by intervening and umpiring political disputes. The Supreme Court was behaving in a perfectly Elian fashion in policing the political process in Bush v. Gore.
It certainly is an example of judicial restraint. They restrained 500,000 voters. It's hard to get more restraint than that.
Professors, if we could pivot a moment to two areas where I think you might agree. The first, we've talked about a number of cases here thus far, Texas v. Johnson, the Jardines case, the Jones case, obviously, Bush v. Gore, and the Obamacare case. I'm wondering if, and this is for both of you, whether any of these cases or some other opinions written by Justice Scalia will still be on first-year con law syllabi in 2066. If so, which one?
Okay, so I would say that Justice Scalia's dissent in Morrison against Olson, where he was the lone dissenter from a majority opinion by Rehnquist that spoke for seven justices on the court, will still be on the curriculum 40 years from now or 45 years from now. Scalia's Morrison dissent is brilliantly written. It illustrates the practical and legal hazards caused by the independent counsel law. The decision was written in 1988. Many Democrats told me during the 1990s, as they screamed in agony about Ken Starr's investigations of Bill Clinton, that Scalia's opinion had been prophetic because it had predicted all the abuses of prosecutorial power that Ken Starr, in fact, committed. I think that the opinion will be of lasting importance as a removal power opinion. It helped establish that the president in general has the power to remove executive branch officials. I think the opinion created an intellectual climate where Congress in 1999 chose not to renew the independent counsel law because both Republicans and Democrats had been convinced by Scalia that the law was unwise and unconstitutional. So I think that's certainly a landmark opinion. Another landmark opinion is Scalia's opinion in Heller against District of Columbia concerning the question of whether the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to own a gun to defend himself or whether it only protects an individual's right to own a rifle when he's serving as a member of a state National Guard unit, which is what we call the militia today. Scalia came out for the personal right to own a gun to defend yourself rather than the National Guard right to own a rifle as part of being a member of a National Guard unit. I think that's a decision of great importance and of great interest to many Americans. And whether there will be a majority or minority favoring Scalia's opinion in Heller, I predict it will still be an issue 40 years from now. And I predict the exchange between Scalia and the dissenting justices in Heller will be studied and discussed. One striking thing about Heller is that even the dissenting opinions are very originalist. They emphasize history, text, original meaning. And in that sense, Heller is a great triumph for originalism as espoused by Justice Scalia.
Professor Koppelman?
So I think that I would agree that Morrison versus Olson is probably the finest piece of work product to come out of Scalia's chambers. It's a very impressive opinion. But there are a couple of dimensions to that. So the independent counsel statute said that based on certain conditions, an independent prosecutor had to be created with job of just investigating a single person. So the case actually had an individual rights dimension because there was there's an old movie called, I guess they keep remaking it, called The Terminator, in which someone is put in the sad position of having this automatic machine that's programmed to just keep coming after them, and it's inexhaustible and unkillable. And one of the values of the executive control over prosecutions is it means that before prosecutorial resources are directed at you, it'll be a discretionary decision by somebody who weighs it against other priorities. The independent counsel overrode those and triggered an automatic investigation, an apparently inexhaustible investigation of a particular person. And that aspect of the statute was brought out quite clearly in Scalia's dissent, so that what one had in that case was both a structural problem about fragmentation of executive power and an individual rights dimension. Let's say that here the constitutional structure means you've got an individual right to a discretionary determination by a prosecutor before that prosecutor directs resources at you. There was another commitment, though, in Morrison versus Olson toward what's been called the unitary executive, which has been, I think the way Scalia understood it, was that any exercise of executive power, individual discretionary decisions about deploying the power of the U.S. government had to be under the supervision of the president or of someone who could be hired or fired by the president. That means that, for example, the fact that the Federal Reserve chairman can't be fired except for cause is unconstitutional. But it really would be pretty terrible for democracy if the president had absolute control over the Federal Reserve. It means that the U.S. economy would get a massive stimulus 6 months before every presidential election. And I think that would really defeat the operation of democracy in the United States. Heller is a sign of Scalia's victory that both Scalia and Justice Stevens in dissent argued about the original meaning of the Second Amendment. That was the ground on which this battle was fought. Hanging over both opinions, though, were very contemporary concerns. There's been some good scholarship on the nature of Second Amendment rights that points out that when the movement to revive Second Amendment rights first arose, it was about rights of independent citizens to form militias for the purpose of resisting the government, which would mean, if you read the Second Amendment that way, that citizens would have a right to some fairly heavy ordnance. They'd have a right to machine guns. They'd have a right to artillery. They'd have a right to the sort of means that one needs in order to resist government power. The discourse changed after the Oklahoma City bombing, which gave militias a bad name, so that and the discourse became one of individual rights to self-defense. And it's through that lens that Scalia read the original sources. Scalia also qualified Second Amendment rights in various ways that, as far as I can tell, had no relation with the original meaning. It said that you had no right to highly unusual weapons such as machine guns or sawed-off shotguns, which can be quite handy for self-defense depending on circumstances. But he thought that those were reasonable based on his own understanding of reasonableness. So that was okay. And he said that any weapon, even a weapon that didn't exist at the time of the framing, that's commonly used for self-defense is protected, which again is a rule that doesn't appear anywhere in the original sources.
If I could respond to those points quickly.
I have a question about the unitary executive for you.
Okay. Well, once you give me the question, I'll respond to that, Andy, as well as answer your question.
I'd like to talk about Heller a bit more later. But before we do, Professor Calabresi, along with Professor Christopher Yu, you are recently an author of The Unitary Executive, Presidential Power from Washington to Bush. Justice Scalia described his lone dissenting vote in Morrison v. Olson as the most wrenching decision of his career. You've already spoken about the decision, and I'd love if you could respond to Professor Koppelman's points about it, but I'd also like if you could talk about the unitary executive and its originalist credentials.
Sure. There are two competing ideas that have been advanced as to what the unitary executive consists of and what it means. And the idea that Chris Yu and I argued for in our book and that Justice Scalia argued for in the Morrison dissent is the one that Professor Koppelman alluded to, which is that the president has to be able to control all people who exercise executive power, either by being able to fire them or being able to fire their boss or conceivably by being able to issue an order to them which they have to follow. So the idea is that the Constitution gives all of the executive power to the president. The president delegates it to a million subordinates. The president can fire subordinates who use executive power in ways that he disagrees with because he alone possesses the executive power. The other vision of the unitary executive, which is associated with John Yoo at Berkeley and who worked for George W. Bush, is that the unitary executive gives the president undefined foreign policy powers, including the power to open the military base at Guantanamo Bay, to engage in waterboarding and enhanced interrogation, and various other undefined foreign policy powers. I repudiate the John Yoo version, but I stand by the version that I argued for with Chris Yoo. Professor Koppelman pointed out that, gee, if the president can fire leading officials in the executive branch, maybe he might fire the Federal Reserve chairman 6 months before the election unless the money supply were jacked up to make it easier for the president to win the election. Well, consider what happened when President Obama was first elected in 2008. The country was in a major financial crisis and downturn. The issue of how to handle that financial crisis and downturn was the central issue, even more than the Iraq War, that caused President Obama to beat John McCain. It was absolutely a central issue to the 2008 presidential election. Now fast forward to January 20th, 2009, President Obama takes office, and he's inherited a chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Ben Bernanke, who was appointed by former President Bush. If Ben Bernanke had chosen at that moment in time to greatly constrict the money supply in order to maybe facilitate going back on the gold standard, I think that would have been highly disruptive, and I think President Obama would have been completely within his rights to fire him for doing that. The fact is that fiscal policy and the money supply are political issues which are debated at election time and which have to be subject to presidential control. So under Professor Koppelman's view, President Obama would just be left fiddling while Ben Bernanke put us back on the gold standard. Under my view, President Obama would have the power to fire Ben Bernanke and replace him with somebody who shared Obama's fiscal policy views. With respect to the Heller case, Professor Koppelman mentioned that Scalia carves out exceptions for machine guns and tanks and heavy ordnance and says that no one has a right to possess those under the Second Amendment. The reason for that is that rights under the Bill of Rights, as it's incorporated by the 14th Amendment, are subject to a caveat which was explained in Corfield against Coryell by Justice Bushrod Washington. Justice Washington listed all the kinds of rights that are protected by the 14th Amendment, and then he says, subject nevertheless to such just laws as may be enacted for the general good of the whole people. So, yes, there's an individual right to own a gun to defend yourself, but it's subject to such just laws as may be enacted for the general good of the whole people. Owning a revolver to defend yourself is reasonable. Owning a machine gun, a tank, or a private nuclear weapon is not. The whole question is whether a government regulation is a just law enacted for the general good of the whole people.
So we've gotten down to these two points. On the unitary executive point, and this is really where the question of what weight to give originalism matters. The modern administrative state is something that wasn't contemplated by the framers, but it arises in response to the problems of a complex 20th century economy. The question of how one deals with an economy of the complexity of the 20th century economy is a question about which the framers had no views. And so one question is whether their views not written into the Constitution ought to be understood as a constraint on the capacity of the present Congress to structure the government in accord with that. Now, one of the things that the present Congress has done that we've had for some decades is a semi-independent Federal Reserve. The president does get to appoint people to it, but doesn't get to fire them freely. Professor Calabresi points out that that could potentially lead to catastrophe. The question about any institution is whether it has in fact led to catastrophe. I can't think of any possible institution that could not, under some possible states of affairs, lead to catastrophe. The question is whether it works or not. And that question isn't a question of original meaning. That's a question of whether the judiciary has a basis for intervening to override the structure on the basis of which the economy has functioned, I think, reasonably well for some decades. The other value of the independence of the Federal Reserve is that the Fed is able to do quite unpopular things when it needs to do it for the economy as a whole, and that's also happened from time to time. On the question of judicially crafted exceptions in Heller, I mean, it is true that at the time of the framing, rights were understood as subject to just laws for the general good of the whole people. I noticed, though, that that standard, just laws for the general good of the whole people, isn't a rule. It's a standard. And if you favor standards over rules, this is likely to be troubling. And then once you say that, then you, I think, could reasonably ask, well, then, given that proviso, if you had circumstances that weren't contemplated by the framers, such as intense urban violence of the kind that people experience in the District of Columbia, could they say, well, one thing that the damage that handguns is doing in the District of Columbia, could we say no handguns in the District of Columbia? Is that a just law for the general good of the whole people? Justice Scalia thought not, but on the basis of criteria that I don't think can be found in the original sources, I think that he understood the Constitution as assigning to him discretion to decide whether gun laws were justified or not. So that the interpretation of the Constitution and the legislation of one's own policy preferences turn out to be indistinguishable in this case.
So just to respond on the unitary executive, Andy mentions we've never had a catastrophe with the Federal Reserve Board, so maybe it's okay that the Federal Reserve Board is independent. We did have a catastrophe with independent prosecutors. That's what the Morrison case was all about, and that's why the statute creating independent prosecutors was repealed. There was an effort during Reconstruction to forbid the president from being able to fire any cabinet secretary or deputy cabinet secretary. That law proved to be so unwise and so unworkable that it too was repealed. We haven't yet had a catastrophe with the Federal Reserve Board, but we've had experiences with limits on presidential removal powers in a number of other contexts, and they've mostly turned out to cause trouble. Let's hope that's not the case with the Federal Reserve Board. I, for one, would interpret the president's power to fire someone for cause as including a power to fire somebody because of a policy disagreement. On the question of machine guns and tanks and the standards applying to rights, I would note that all rights are subject to some limiting circumstances in which they can be overridden. Our right to freedom of speech does not include the right to cry fire in a crowded theater. Our right to freedom of speech does not include a right to run a sound truck through a residential neighborhood at 4 o'clock in the morning. Similarly, our right to own guns doesn't include a right to own machine guns or tanks or nuclear weapons because they're so dangerous to other people. The standard in Justice Bushrod Washington's opinion in Corfield against Coryell, subject nevertheless to such just laws enacted for the general good of the whole people, is a standard that was mentioned by the framers of the 14th Amendment and endorsed by them. It is a standard. It's not a rule. It's hard to apply because of that. One might try to apply it by having some bright lines in terms of how to apply it, like, say, no machine guns, no tanks, no nuclear weapons, yes, 48 caliber pistols. I think Scalia's preference for rules over standards would cause one to try to apply the just laws enacted for the general good of the whole people
in a way that employed rules as much as possible rather than balancing tests.
Although I noticed that that means that there is a tension, and I think clearly there's a tension between the preference for rules over standards and the commitment to the original meaning of the Constitution, given that there are so many texts in the Constitution that clearly enact standards and not rules.
And Andy's absolutely right about that. And I guess I would add to that, I think that Justice Scalia would respond by saying that his preference for rules over standards comes from the fact that he's only authorized to exercise the judicial power, and the judicial power includes a mandate that you make decisions not for policy reasons but based on law. So I think he would say that the text giving him judicial power is part of what causes him to construe language to be as rule-like as possible, even where the Constitution applies standards.
If we could move just a moment away from guns and lawyers, as interesting as both of those topics are, I'd hope to talk about an area where Justice Scalia was also influential, the religion clauses of the First Amendment. Professor Koppelman, you're the author of Defending American Religious Neutrality, and in that book, correct me if I'm wrong, you argue that the First Amendment provides broad protection for religion and religious neutrality as two desirable social goods. So turning to the court's religion clause jurisprudence, and specifically Justice Scalia's work in that area, where do you see his views on religious liberty as most consistent with an original view of the First Amendment's religion clauses, and do you think those views will persist past his time on the bench?
Well, there are two broad aspects of the religion clauses. So the First Amendment says in pertinent part, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That's the part that we call the Establishment Clause, or abridging the free exercise thereof. That's the Free Exercise Clause. With respect to the Free Exercise Clause, Justice Scalia has read that to mean that you can't have laws based on religious bigotry. But otherwise, if a law keeps somebody from doing what they want to for religious reasons, that they don't have a claim under the Free Exercise Clause. And he did that largely on the basis of considerations of judicial restraint. If somebody asks for religious accommodation, they are asking for the court to make a discretionary judgment about the consequences of accommodating them. And Scalia was nervous about giving judges the power to do that as a matter of constitutional law. I think that he had a good point about this. He wanted the last word about these discretionary judgments to go to the legislature and not the judiciary, since the legislature was able to find out things about the world and to revise its judgments. And I think that he's on fairly firm ground with that. If, as long as the legislature was taking the last word, he was very happy to enforce the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act as applied to the federal government. And so when he was able to accommodate free exercise in ways that were narrowly bounded rules, like the rule in Hosanna Tabor that religious groups get to decide their own clergy, he was willing to do that. I think that he was on firm ground with respect to the Free Exercise Clause. I think that those holdings are likely to persist. With respect to the Establishment Clause, I think that he liked public celebrations of religion. Those were in tension with commitments which were quite deeply rooted at the time of the framing, that the government was not to take a position on any live religious issue. And he ended up saying that, trying to defend Ten Commandments displays, for example, that were paid for by government or on government land, that it was perfectly fine for a government to say and to publicly announce that its judgment on certain theological matters was sound as long as it was a matter of overlap among the major monotheistic religions. So I said, since Judaism and Christianity and Islam all agree that the Ten Commandments are come from God, therefore it was okay for the state to adjudicate this theological disagreement and say that Buddhists and Hindus and atheists and agnostics are mistaken. Now, one of the foundational commitments at the beginning that was shared across multiple rather different theological viewpoints was that the state is not a reliable guide to religious truth. So here, it seems to me that the pretension to originalism is there's no original basis for this idea. What he's really done is imported into constitutional law the Islamic notion of the people of the book. And the originalist credentials here just aren't very good. I think that he read this into the Constitution because it reached results that he liked and that made sense to him.
If I could respond, on starting with the Establishment Clause, there was early practice under the Constitution of President George Washington issuing Thanksgiving Day proclamations declaring a national day of Thanksgiving as a time to reflect on the prior year's events. The framers also approved money for chaplains for the House of Representatives and for the Senate and made chaplains available to the military. I agree with Andy that government should not noisily take sides in religious disputes or favor issues that are favored by one religion over another. But I think that government can proclaim days of Thanksgiving and hire chaplains as a way of facilitating and accommodating the expression of religious opinion. I think by far Justice Scalia's most important vote on an Establishment Clause issue was on whether it's permissible for government to allow public money in a voucher system to go to a religious school rather than a secular public school. And Justice Scalia was twice part of a 5-4 majority which upheld allowing public money to go to religious schools as well as secular schools. Scalia's point in upholding that was that the person making the choice about where the money goes is not the government. It's the parent of the child who chooses to cash the voucher either at a secular public school or at a religious public school. And so it's not the government making the choice about religion. It's the parent making the choice about religion. On free exercise, I think Hosanna-Tabor, the ministerial exception case, may end up undermining Scalia's opinion in Employment Division against Smith more substantially than we currently realize. Hosanna-Tabor really does favor treating religion differently, at least when it comes to implying employment laws against ministers. I think Scalia misread the Free Exercise Clause. He read it as a clause that protected freedom of conscience and belief. But it actually protects more than conscience and belief. It protects exercise, taking action, worshiping. And so I think it allows – I think that in Smith, for example, where a Native American person wanted to ingest peyote in a religious ritual, the court ought to have ruled in favor of allowing the ingestion of the peyote. One final Scalia Religion Clause dissent, which I predict will turn out to be of importance in majority opinions in the future, was in Locke v. Davy. And in Locke v. Davy, court had to consider a complaint by a University of Washington student who chose, instead of getting a PhD in philosophy, to go to divinity school. Washington State had a Blaine Amendment in its state constitution which forbade any state money from going to from being spent by a religious institution. The state of Washington said, therefore, they could subsidize a PhD in philosophy but not a degree in divinity. Scalia argued that that was a violation of equal protection ideas, and I think he was right. I think that religion should be a suspect classification for equal protection purposes, and that laws that discriminate on the basis of religion, like the Blaine Amendment, should get strict scrutiny.
So on these two, I'm happy to end on a note of defending Justice Scalia against Professor Calabresi's attack. But on Locke versus Davy, there's a number of different interpretations of what separation of church and state amounts to. What the state did in Locke was really the same thing that the Supreme Court had done in the 1970s, to say, given that we are concerned about division along religious lines, about religion, religion being corrupted by the desire to get access to state largesse. We're just going to say that no state money can go to religious activities, thereby maintaining a clearer separation between them in order to make religion more autonomous from state influence. If religion can get state money, the state can put conditions on that money. You can get religious competition over the money. The Locke versus Davy held that that was a permissible way for the state to try to maintain separation. And I don't think that Scalia gave enough weight to those considerations, as generally I think that Scalia didn't give enough weight to the concern, which was ubiquitous at the time of the founding, that allowing state involvement with religion would be corrupting of religion. This was a religion-friendly concern, and I don't think that Scalia ever acknowledged it in any of his opinions, even the ones that emphasized originalism. On Hassanna Tabor, if the concern is that Hassanna Tabor is going to undermine Smith, Hassanna Tabor was quite clearly based on the internal decisions of the church, the capacity of the church to choose its own leaders. And here, you know, given that any interpretation of the free exercise clause is going to be judge-made law, Scalia was apprehensive, and I think quite rightly apprehensive, of judges saying, as a matter of constitutional law, you know, when someone comes asking for an accommodation, if we make a guess, all that the judiciary can do is make a guess that accommodating this person is not going to defeat the underlying purposes of the law, creates a real problem if it should turn out that the judiciary was wrong about that. So in the Peyote case, if it should happen, one possible scenario, had the dissenters won in the Peyote case, is that lots of people might decide, oh, I've got to convert to this religion in order to be able to use these hallucinogens. Lots of people might do that. Hallucinogens, if abused, are quite dangerous. They can trigger psychotic episodes. You could have an epidemic of psychotic episodes, and the court would have said there's a constitutional right to that. And so then they'd be in the embarrassing position either of saying the Constitution has changed since the last time we looked at this religious liberty issue, or that the Constitution requires us to tolerate psychotic episodes, neither of which is a happy outcome.
Just to put this in context, what Andy is saying is that during Prohibition, government should have been able to forbid the use of wine in the Eucharist because, after all, wine, if consumed in large quantities, can have harmful effects on your health and can be quite dangerous and can lead people to get into drunk driving accidents and all sorts of other things. I think use of a minimal amount of wine in as part of a ceremony of worship, or use of a minimal amount of peyote as part of a ceremony of worship, is entirely different from ingesting those substances as a recreational drug. And I think everybody is able to appreciate the difference, and that that's not a line that would, in fact, be hard to enforce.
It seems like a very sensible, prudential judgment of the kind that legislators, in fact, did make under Prohibition. They were under no constraint by the courts, certainly. But the question is whether that line's appropriately drawn by judges. And here it seems to me that Scalia's worries are well taken.
Thank you, Professor Koppelman, for your time here today. At this time, we're going to shift to discussing with Professor Calabresi his time clerking for Justice Scalia and some stories from that time in Justice Scalia's career.
Well, I should begin by saying that I first met Justice Scalia in April of 1982 when I was part of a group of three students who were co-founding the Federalist Society. The Federalist Society became a national organization of lawyers, law students, law professors, and judges, and today has more than 50,000 members. We organized the first conference in April 1982 on federalism, and Justice Scalia was then Professor Scalia, and he was our faculty advisor, and it was Scalia who called up a foundation in New York and got us a $20,000 grant to hold our first meeting. So he literally made the creation of the Federalist Society possible. He came to that first conference, participated very notably in it, and participated in many Federalist Society events after that. From 1984 to 1985, I clerked for Judge Robert Bork on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, which Justice Scalia was then also a judge on. And just Judge Scalia's chambers were next door to Judge Bork's chambers, and two of my best friends were working as clerks for Judge Scalia. And I saw as much of Scalia as I did of Judge Bork and liked him enormously. He was very energetic, constantly dashing out memos to the other judges on the court, which got to be called ninograms, objecting to points here, arguing for changes of language there. He was clearly clearly the most engaged judge on the D.C. Circuit, involved in all the court's cases and all the court's activities. After I finished clerking for Judge Bork, I went to work for Attorney General Ed Meese as a special assistant in the Justice Department. And I was part of a team of 18 lawyers who were charged with coming up with and evaluating potential candidates for appointment to the Supreme Court. I lended my voice to the voice of many other people and argued that Scalia and Bork were clearly the two best people on Reagan's list, and they were head and shoulders above anyone else on the list. And I think that that support by me and by many other people made a very strong impression on Attorney General Meese, who in turn made a very strong impression on President Reagan. I think during the year I clerked for Justice Scalia, which was 1987 to 1988, the year began with Justice Lewis Powell resigning. And so for most of the year, there was only a court of eight justices. Judge Bork was nominated to replace Justice Powell, but was not confirmed. A second nomination of Judge Douglas Ginsburg was also not confirmed. In fact, he withdrew the nomination. And then finally, Justice Kennedy was nominated for that spot and was confirmed. I have many happy memories of working with Justice Scalia as a law clerk. He used to like to run fairly long distances. We would run from the Supreme Court building down to the Lincoln Memorial, over to the Jefferson Memorial, and then back up the mall, back up to the Supreme Court building. Scalia jokingly would ask his clerks as they were running to tell him a little bit about the cases that were coming up on the docket 2 or 3 weeks into the future. And he said laughingly, "This is my way of equalizing a race with a bunch of 25-year-olds when I'm in my 50s. You guys have to talk and I get to listen and grunt yes or no." Notwithstanding that, when we got back to the court, he invited us to use the private shower off of his chambers to get cleaned up so we could go back to work again, which we inevitably did. And exercising with Justice Scalia and socializing with him was a very important part of the clerkship. Another thing the justice did that really sticks out in my mind is that the night before conference, when the justices would get together to vote on the cases, he would gather all the clerks in the office before him, and he would ask us to make the strongest arguments pro and con on every single case that was up for decision. And he would sometimes join in making arguments in favor of an outcome or against an outcome. And sometimes we were terrified that he was going to go into conference and vote in a way that we thought was foolish. And it would turn out the next day that he was just pulling our leg and was arguing the contrary position as strongly as he could argue it. But in fact, he voted the way we thought he should vote. I do remember seeing him after the conference in Morrison against Olson, which was decided the year I clerked on the court. We heard about the 7-1 vote, and the clerks filed into his office very quietly to say how sorry we felt. And he was sitting in a leather green armchair with his feet up on a stool reading a book, and he looked at us with tears in his eyes, and he just sort of waved us away. So he was, you know, he took these decisions very personally. He cared passionately about the Constitution and about getting the Constitution right. And it really affected him when he lost a fight over something that he thought was fundamentally important like that. One thing I should say about Justice Scalia is that I will never forget his tremendous sense of humor. And there are two jokes he told about himself, which I feel I should mention here, which I think were particularly revealing. First, when he was law professor at the University of Chicago, he was nominated to be a federal judge. And when you're nominated for a judgeship or a cabinet secretaryship, the FBI does a background check where they send agents around to talk to all your neighbors and to talk to everyone at your workplace to make sure that you don't have any hidden scandals. Well, Scalia, while he was at the University of Chicago Law School, had decided not to attend Mass at the Catholic chapel at the University of Chicago because he thought it was too liberal. And so instead, he went to Mass at a little Catholic church in the Italian-American neighborhood of Chicago. One April, he went to Mass, and as he was coming out, the priest tugged at his sleeves as he was coming out the door and said, "Nino, hang on a second. Wait till everyone's gone. I need to talk to you." And so he did, and then all the other parishioners filed out and left, and the priest turned to Scalia and, with a look of tremendous concern on his face, said, Nino, I have terrible, terrible news. It's really awful news." And Scalia said, "Well, what is it, Father?" He said, "Nino, it's the FBI. They're after you. They were here asking questions all day yesterday of everybody. But Nino, don't worry. I told them nothing." That's an example of the justice's ability to both make fun of his going to an untraditional church. And then the other funny story he told me was once he was traveling cross-country with one of his sons, and he pulled over for the night in Kansas to spend the night at a motel. He went up to the desk clerk and asked for a room, and the desk clerk said, "What's your name?" And he said, "Scalia." And the desk clerk said, "You're going to have to spell that one for me." So he spelled it out, and the desk clerk looked at it and said, "Oh, Scalia, just like the Supreme Court justice." And he said, "One and the same." But he was always able to laugh at himself. Even after 29 years on the Supreme Court, he related well to everybody, to his clerks, to ordinary people. He did not have an overly inflated sense of his own importance, and he was a wonderfully warm and wonderfully funny man. And whenever I think of him, I smile because he usually made people smile. He usually had fun things to say.
Well, thank you, Professor Calabresi, for your time here, for your stories, and for wrangling with Professor Koppelman.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it a lot.
That was Professor Stephen Calabresi and Andrew Koppelman discussing the legacy of the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and the legacy of his originalist jurisprudence. To get the latest from Northwestern University Law Review online, head to our website, northwesternlawreview.org/online. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Before we conclude our episode, I want to thank David Ettinger, our media guru here at Northwestern Law. And that concludes our episode today. Thank you for listening. Until the next time.